Podcasts for PRI's The World are made possible in part by the generous support of our donors. Visit PRI.org/give and ensure that outstanding global programming continues. After all, it's your world. Jump in. South Sudan's Rude Awakening. Today, Thursday, December 26th. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. More than 1,000 are believed dead in the ethnic violence that's engulfing South Sudan. We reach a reporter in Juba working to understand the root causes.
It's about politics, it's about oil, and it's about ethnicity.
Also today, why a shrine honoring Japan's war dead continues to divide the region. Plus, a ship trapped in the Antarctic ice, but this passenger doesn't mind.
I love it when the ice wins and we don't. And it's just, it reminds you that, you know, as humans, we don't control everything and that the natural world, it's the winner here.
Plus, a microbrewer tries to win over the French.
Because I think that cheese and beer goes better than cheese and wine, especially red wine.
Support for PRI's The World comes from Medtronic Philanthropy, expanding access to chronic disease care for the underserved by supporting organizations and communities where they live and work, such as Memphis-based Church Healthcare Center. You can learn more at MedtronicPhilanthropy.com.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. It's all too familiar to the people of South Sudan. All of a sudden, the world's newest nation seems to be tearing itself apart. According to the UN, more than 1,000 people have died in violence that's flared up out of seemingly nowhere. The UN Special Envoy to South Sudan, Hilda Johnson, said today in Juba, the capital, that people are terrified.
What has happened this last week has, for many of them, brought back the nightmares of the past. The nationhood painstakingly built over decades of conflict and strife is at stake. And for us, one of the most important things is to have those nightmares end.
Johnson appealed to the leaders of the warring factions to order their forces to lay down their arms. Heidi Vogt is with the Wall Street Journal. We reached her earlier in Juba.
The violence is not happening in Juba at this point. Juba is dealing with a real humanitarian crisis with more than 20,000 people taking shelter at UN camps. But fighting is happening up in the oil-producing states of Unity and Upper Nile, with heavy fighting even today in those state capitals. Government forces are battling the rebel troops there.
So presumably those thousands of people who are in a refugee camp in Juba, they're fleeing that fighting in the north?
No, these are people who have were fleeing fighting that happened in Juba more than a week ago now. This is where all of these clashes started, because what we've had here was ethnic targeting, the Dinka and Nuer ethnic groups fighting each other. And so in Juba, the Nuer who were targeted fled to these camps. I talked to a number of people yesterday at one of these camps, and I said, you know, it's quiet out there. I'm driving around Juba. And they said, yeah, but I can't go home. The soldiers will come at night and they will kill me.
So tell me some more stories about the people at those camps. I mean, what are they telling you, I mean, aside from their fear of going back home?
There's some really awful stories. I mean, what we've basically got is people saying that soldiers of the Dinka ethnicity started hunting down civilians of the Nuer ethnicity in the city. They came into these people's houses. When I said, we were all already hiding under the beds because there was so much shooting. And this soldier burst in the door, started talking to us in the Dinka language. And when we couldn't reply in the right accent, he started shooting. And one of his family members was killed. And there are stories like that by the hundreds all over this city.
Are these refugees as shocked as the rest of the world that this new nation of South Sudan is just collapsing?
You know, what is scary is that they are not nearly as shocked as we, the rest of the world, are, because this area was riven by ethnic divisions long before independence. There was a civil war being fought for decades that included ethnic massacres. And so what we're seeing here is South Sudanese who, when they gained independence in 2011 and all these old enemies came together to form a new country, now they're saying, you know, we thought we had all of this hope, and now it seems like it's just returned to the same way it was with everybody killing each other.
I mean, it just sounds so chaotic, with pockets of violence in many different places for seemingly different reasons. Have you figured out what it's about? Is it ethnic? Is it about oil?
It's about politics. It's about oil, and it's about ethnicity. What we really have here is something that started as a political power struggle between the president and his former vice president, who had announced he was going to run against him in upcoming elections in 2015. President Kiir had sidelined a number of Mr. Machar's allies to the point that we had a clash in the Presidential Guard Sunday night in Juba, with people, presidential guards who were getting fired, fighting back. And that became an ethnic brawl. And then that spiraled out into the states. And then as soon as it got into these oil producing regions, we have these now rebel forces saying, well, we're going to get control of the oil, and that's how we're going to get control of the country.
I hear that talks are being held to try and find a way out of this, but that would assume that President Salva Kiir and his former deputy Riek Machar could be in the same room at the same time. Are we even there yet?
No. We're hearing a lot from diplomats about progress in these talks, but the one thing we have to recognize is the talks at this point are only with President Kiir. Until Riek Machar is part of these talks, it's hard to see any progress being made.
The Wall Street Journal's Heidi Vogt in Juba, the South Sudanese capital. Thank you.
Okay, thanks.
The country that South Sudan gained independence from in 2011 is its neighbor to the north, Sudan. And relations between the two have remained tense since then, largely over oil. Journalist Ismail Kushkush says the new spike of violence in the south has put Sudan on edge. He's been reporting from the capital, Khartoum, for the New York Times.
People are not surprised that this happened. Like I said, they're familiar with the politics and the makeup of South Sudan. I mean, the general sense is, you know, we expected this. People are concerned of what kind of impact this will have on the economy. South Sudanese oil flows through pipelines through Sudan. This will have impact on the oil revenues. There's concern that there will be many refugees heading towards the states that border with South Sudan. And of course, there's concern over the political impact. There are agreements over issues that are left over from the comprehensive peace agreement that ended the civil war in 2005. So issues like the borders, the issues of citizenship, agreements have been made, but they have not been fully implemented yet. So the impact of these events in South Sudan are of great concern here in Sudan.
I mean, it sounds like the first big concern is economic, and specifically oil, which is a concern that was shared by Sudan's information minister this past week. Concerns about what's going to happen to that oil from South Sudan. Apparently, South Sudan pays Khartoum to move oil through those pipelines you were talking about up to Sudan for export. What is the history of these pipelines? I mean, how is Sudan dependent upon oil production from the south?
When it was one country, most of the oil fields were in and are in South Sudan, and the pipelines and the refineries are in the northern parts of the country, in what today is Sudan, and the pipelines go to the Red Sea, to the Port Sudan, where they are exported. When separation happened in 2011, there were disagreements on how the oil revenue would be shared, and both countries almost went to war over this last year. But after several rounds of talks, they came to an agreement. South Sudan pays a fee for the usage of the refinery and for the flow of oil through pipelines through Sudan. Sudan gets a percentage of that. And, of course, this is it's an important revenue for Sudan. Before separation, oil was about 75% of its source of revenue. Even for South Sudan, this will have a great impact because oil is 98% source of revenue in South Sudan. So any disruption of oil for both countries would have a great economic impact.
Right. It's going to hit both sides, both the north and the south. I mean, despite the brutal and long civil war between what is now Sudan and South Sudan, does the average Sudanese in Khartoum feel like South Sudan really should never have been allowed to break away? Do they feel the country still belongs to them?
There are different views on what the relationship was and should have been and should be. There is a percentage that feels that, you know, South Sudan should have not been allowed to vote on whether to become independent or not. There are those actually also who believe that it might be better for the South to have its own country, thinking that this would solve the problems of Sudan. Of course, that did not happen.
Journalist Ismail Kushkush speaking with us from Khartoum. He files for the New York Times. Ismail, thanks very much.
You're welcome. Thank you.
There are many great photographs, but I can think of only a handful of iconic photos. Robert Capa's picture of the moment a soldier is shot during the Spanish Civil War, or the naked Vietnamese girl fleeing napalm during the war there. There's another iconic shot of a girl in Afghanistan. You know, the one she appeared in National Geographic, a scared face, half-veiled, with otherworldly, piercing green eyes. Photographer Steve McCurry took that photograph while covering the refugee crisis during the war in Afghanistan in the 1980s. McCurry has a new book out, Untold, the Stories Behind the Photographs, and he told us how that image happened.
It fascinates me in photography which pictures people connect with. My name is Steve McCurry. I'm a photographer. Well, this is the story about the Afghan girl photograph I made, I guess it was back in 1984. I was walking through this refugee camp, and I noticed there was a school in a tent, and I heard these voices coming from the school, and I wandered over and went in, and I immediately saw this one incredible girl sitting off in the corner with this very beautiful face and these very kind of haunted eyes. And I knew instantly that this was an incredible portrait possibility. She kind of sat there, looked into my lens with this incredible expression. And, it, you know, the whole situation was perfect in sense of composition and the light, the background, the color of her shawl. And it was one of those rare moments where all the elements in a photograph come together and kind of align themselves into this perfect situation. Eventually, when I got back to National Geographic about 2 months after making the picture, I was going through my film, and I suddenly saw this incredible portrait. It was a bit disturbing, and there was this sort of traumatic quality to her expression, but I thought it really spoke to the situation of 2 or 3 million Afghan refugees living in these awful tents. So eventually, the editor put this picture on the cover of the June 1985 issue, and immediately we had thousands of letters pouring in, people wanting to know, you know, who is she? What's her name? How can we help her? We want to send her clothes. We want to send her money. There were even men that wanted to marry her. It was this incredible outpouring of interest, and that interest never subsided. I think people all over the world really connected with this picture. So I'm sure the first line of my obituary will be, you know, Steve McCurry was the photographer of the Afghan refugee girl, blah, 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 blah. and that'll be pretty much it for me, I suppose. You know, I'm okay with that. I think that to have a photograph that people appreciate, connect with, can learn something from, have an emotional experience with, is a great thing. And I think any photographer would be proud to have made such a picture.
That's photographer Steve McCurry. 17 years later, he reconnected with the Afghan girl, Sharbat Gula. She's married and living in Afghanistan. McCurry and Gula now stay regularly in touch. Still ahead, why a shrine is so important to Japan and so controversial to China. Later, here on The World, from PRI, Public Radio International, and PRI.org.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from Lumosity.com, the brain training program designed by neuroscientists and used by 50 million people, created to improve memory and attention. More at Lumosity.com. And by Medtronic Philanthropy, expanding access to chronic disease care for the underserved by supporting organizations in communities where they live and work, such as Memphis-based Church Health Center. You can learn more at MedtronicPhilanthropy.com.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. It's nice to be home for the holidays. Yeah, I know. Mostly nice. Sometimes, though, home for the holidays means getting stuck in an airport lounge or in bumper-to-bumper traffic. Or like many thousands of Americans and Canadians today, in a home without electricity. No doubt about it, home for the holidays can be stressful. But wherever you are, it's all about making the best of it. 74 people stuck in ice in the Antarctic are certainly trying to make the best of it. They're aboard the research ship, the Akademik Shokalski. The vessel has been stuck in dense pack ice since Tuesday. The group of scientists and tourists on board are recreating Sir Douglas Mawson's historic voyage to Antarctica about a century ago. But in the Shokalski's case, a blizzard and strong winds force the ice to close in on the ship. Now it's stuck about 1,500 nautical miles south of Hobart, Australia, near a French Antarctic base. Among the passengers is BBC reporter Andrew Luck Baker. He's covering the expedition for a BBC science program. And since he had some time on his hands, he interviewed some of his fellow passengers.
It's all a little bit uncertain at the moment as to how long we're going to be stuck here. And, you know, we've been told that there are some fairly sizable icebergs that are moving, whereas we're, relatively speaking, static. How does that make you feel?
I'm pretty confident in both Greg and the captain. They're more than experienced, and the ship seems solid. I think we'll be good.
Hello, Judy.
Hi.
How are you enjoying this experience of being marooned in a pack of ice?
Well, it's what a way to spend a Christmas day, that's all I can say. And, yeah, I'm thinking of my daughter at the moment.
Are you okay? You're feeling all right about the situation, are you? Because the briefing that we had, they were reassuring us that if needs be, there was going to be assistance from icebreakers sort of in the area. I think we're going to be fine, don't you?
I hope so.
We'll be fine.
Thank you, Andrew. I like your optimism. There's plenty of ships around, so that's the main thing.
Tracy, as a scientist who comes down to Antarctica quite a lot, is this a novel experience for you, being stuck in pack ice with quite large icebergs drifting past?
No, actually, I've been stuck a couple of times, and I think it's fantastic. I love it when the ice wins and we don't, and it's just, it reminds you that, you know, as humans, we don't control everything, and that the natural world, it's, if you don't, it's the winner here. We have a saying in Australia, shit happens, and this is it, Andrew. Now, you're having fun. What do you think, Andrew? What do you think? Look out here, look at this. It's divine.
This is the first thing to say. The scene is absolutely beautiful.
We've got birds flying around Cape Petrels. We've got a series of penguins watching us thinking, what the hell are you doing stuck in our ice? It's just, and the skies are beautiful, grey. Feels like it wants to have a bit of a snow. It's the perfect Christmas, really, don't you think?
This is the most exciting Christmas day I think I've ever had, and I probably will ever have.
Now we just have to guess and hope, wonder which icebreaker's going to come rescue us, which is always exciting as well. Will it be the Chinese? Will it be the Australians? Will it be the French?
I think the Chinese icebreaker is supposed to be the closest right now.
I don't know, the French would be good because they bring good food. Do you think?
We might get some really good wine brought.
Really, really good wine? I think that would be excellent.
I'll let you get back into the warm. See you later.
That was BBC reporter Andrew Luck Baker aboard the Shokalski. Today, the Australian Maritime Safety Authority said that three ships with ice-breaking capability are en route to the vessel. If you want to see a video shot in a blizzard from the deck of the Shokalski today and see a map tracking the ship's progress, it's all at PRI.org. Now, all of this got me thinking about what's going on with ice generally. Is it melting or increasing? Let's turn to the other pole now, the Arctic. And joining us for one of his periodic ice updates is the world's environment editor, Peter Thompson. Peter, what is going on with ice?
Well, Marco, you might remember that around this time last year, we were talking about this record drop in Arctic ice at the end of the Arctic summer. The ice stops melting around October, and there was this huge, alarming drop. This year, the news is actually the opposite. It's up significantly.
So does that mean people who were worried about all the ice melting last year were wrong to worry?
Well, no. And that's one of the things that when you talk about climate change, when you talk about any big global process. You have to look over long periods of time. The trajectory is still very much that the ice in the Arctic is going down. Last year, we had this record minimum, as I said, of about 6,000 cubic kilometers of ice in the Arctic in October. This year, they found that's up about 50% to about 9,000 heading into the winter freezing period. That's a remarkable jump, except when you think back to 1980 or so when they first started looking at ice mass in the Arctic. The average at that point was 20,000. So we're still down more than half. One scientist put it well, if you were going to grade the Arctic on its ice, last year it gets an F. This year, maybe a D.
So is it all bad news then? If you pull back and you look at this graph, it's all going down?
Well, in the short term, it's good news. A colder Arctic with more ice is generally better for the climate system in the rest of the world and in the Arctic itself.
Peter, just remind us why ice matters. I mean, aside from habitat for polar bears, which is important, why is ice important?
Well, yeah, I mean, polar bears and a lot of other Arctic animals absolutely need a thick, regular ice cover. But there's a lot more at stake. One big thing is that when there's less ice, the darker ocean absorbs more sunlight. That warms the water. That warms the air. That contributes to the whole process of global warming that has got the ice melting in the first place. There's also concern about methane that's locked up underneath the Arctic Ocean and the sediments there, frozen methane, that as the water warms, it starts to warm those sediments. A little bit more of that methane starts to come out. It goes up into the atmosphere. It's a powerful greenhouse gas. That does the same kind of thing, another feedback loop. The science on that is still very uncertain, but it's definitely a concern.
And those concerns are for the future, years, maybe even decades away. What about right now? What should we be worried about?
Well, one big concern right now is that the warming Arctic is actually messing up the jet stream and how that carries weather systems around the world, how it carries warm fronts, cold fronts, storms, how fast it moves, and that some of the extreme weather that we've been experiencing down here in the temperate latitudes may be in part because the Arctic, as it warms, is causing the jet stream to do weird things. This, too, is also, it's very controversial science, but it's getting more traction in the climate science community. One Arctic researcher, I think, put it really well recently when he said that, unlike Vegas, what happens in the Arctic doesn't stay in the Arctic.
Very well put. So what can I do? What can anybody hearing this do to stop this?
Well, it really all comes down to putting less carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases into the atmosphere. I mean, you don't have to care about this, but if you do care about this, drive less, insulate your house better, switch from natural gas, oil, coal to solar, wind. The ways in which we can wrestle with that are growing fast and furious. It's a gigantic battleship that we've got to turn around. But we can all do little things as a society. We can do more. As a globe, we can do more. And it's just a matter of trying to find what we can do and doing it.
Many drops into a bucket. You know what happens. The World's Environment Editor, Peter Thompson, thank you.
Thanks, Marco.
Ahead, Christian rock takes hold in overwhelmingly Muslim Pakistan. This guitarist says his band isn't about winning converts. They just want to put out a universal message.
We don't want to present ourselves like from Catholics, from Protestants, or from Pentecostals. We just want to show that we are just Christians.
Support for PRI's The World comes from Medtronic Philanthropy, expanding access to chronic disease care for the underserved by supporting organizations and communities where they live and work, such as Memphis-based Church Healthcare Center. You can learn more at medtronicphilanthropy.com.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World, a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH in Boston. I don't think it's an exaggeration to say that it's been a horrible year for Syria. I mean, in just the past 2 weeks, a bombing campaign against rebel-held parts of Aleppo killed more than 350 people, according to activists. And across northern Syria, the mainstream rebel group, the Free Syrian Army, is losing out to a coalition of Islamic extremists. Marine Olivezi tells a story now of one FSA unit that operated in Latakia province. It started the year as a major player, but ended the year in shambles.
This is a tale of two brothers, Hassan and Kamal Hamami. Though 14 years apart, the pair had always been close. Before the revolution, they sold meat and dabbled in real estate in their sun-drenched seaside hometown of Latakia. When demonstrations began in March 2011, the two brothers became ringleaders. Protests grew bigger every day across Syria, but Latakia was not like any other restive city. As the stronghold of Syrian President Bashar al-Assad and his Alawite sect, security forces couldn't be seen to lose control there, so they cracked down on protesters with extra vigor. Hassan, a father of five boys, was arrested in August 2011. His younger brother, Kamal, joined the armed insurgency a few months later and became a senior commander in the Free Syrian Army, one of the few to be respected by both rank-and-file fighters and the leaders in exile. A few months ago, on July 11th, Hassan called his brother, Kamal, to say he was finally going to be released after 2 years in jail.
My brother was so happy. He told me that he was waiting for me, and he wanted me by his side to lead the brigade together. A few hours later, some of my friends at the jail invited me to break the Ramadan fast. After we finished eating, I noticed people were looking at me in a weird way. At the end, one of my friends broke the news to me. My brother had just been killed.
Barely half an hour after the two brothers spoke on the phone, Kamal was gunned down by the local head of the Islamic State, an Al-Qaeda-linked group that has spread across northern Syria this year. It was the first time that radical Islamists had killed a top FSA leader. When Hassan came out of jail a few days later, the death of his brother had changed his priorities.
My focus had shifted to Abu Ayman, the man who killed my brother. The Islamic State corrupted our revolution, and I thought, we have to fight them before we take down the regime.
Hassan tried to get fighters on board, but didn't find much support. He says some FSA leaders pledged to help, but didn't. Others were simply too scared to pick a fight against Al-Qaeda. Overall, Hassan says his brother's death was a missed opportunity for the FSA and its leaders.
They've shown absolutely no foresight. My brother's death should have been a wake-up call, but the top commanders didn't do anything. They should have stood by us, but instead they backed out.
So Hassan decided to kill Abu Ayman himself. His cousin and an old friend, Mazen, both heads of local brigades, helped him set up a trap. The assassination attempt failed when Mazen sold them out at the last minute. Hassan says that's when the ugly truth came out. Some Free Syrian Army leaders are colluding with radical extremists in exchange for cash and protection. Then, the last straw. One early morning last month, 40 Al-Qaeda militants raided the brigade's warehouse and looted dozens of Kalashnikovs, RPGs, and anti-aircraft machine guns while chanting, "God is great." With its charismatic leader killed and its weapons gone, the Amami's brigade had reached the endgame. Hassan says the whole FSA is actually heading that way.
Now we only hear about the Islamic groups and Al-Qaeda on the ground. If the other brigades continue falling apart like this, it'll be game over soon for the FSA.
Many in the opposition have long chastised Western countries for the lack of support, especially now that the Islamist groups seem to be taking over. But Hassan says since his release from jail, he's seen something even more troubling happening on the ground.
I was shocked because I saw my people, the Latakian people, hate each other. Even friends you knew before have become like enemies. Everyone now is alone, against everyone else. Finding radical Islamists all over my homeland was a surprise, but this is even more painful.
Yet Hassan isn't ready to give up. He's still trying to forge a coalition to fight Al-Qaeda and reclaim the revolution. He says money isn't an issue. The real challenge is finding leaders willing to take on the well-trained, well-funded Islamist groups. For The World, I'm Marine Olivesi in Mersin, Turkey.
War crimes cast a very long shadow. Think about the Holocaust or any of the Armenian Americans who remember the fate of their great-grandparents. The same is true for China and South Korea. It's almost 70 years since the end of World War II, and yet today we've seen a storm of protests in China and Korea against Japan. All it took was for the Japanese Prime Minister, Shinzo Abe, to visit a shrine, which he did this morning. It's a Yasukuni shrine that commemorates Japan's war dead. So for today's The World That Was, our history guy Chris Wolf is here to help us understand why China and South Korea are so mad. First of all, what is this Yasukuni shrine, Chris?
It's a national religious institution. It's the home of the kami, which is the Japanese word for kind of revered spirits, which can be translated as gods, probably closer to saints in kind of the Western universe. They're respected, revered, almost have a holy quality to the people who are inducted in there. And it contains all of those who've died in the service of Japan since about 1867 when the thing was built up. So it's mostly military men, but some civilians as well, you know, workers who are killed in air raids, working in vital munitions industries, but not those from like the general population who'd be killed in air raids, you know, what might be called now collateral damage.
Right. So for many Japanese, it's a sacred spot. Why is a shrine so controversial then?
There's a lot of reasons, but principally that a lot of convicted and executed war criminals were inducted into the shrine. Also, it's not just a memorial. It's also a museum of bad history. The way the history of the World War II and the preceding conflict with China is presented is very nationalistic and certainly excludes the details of the many, many atrocities that took place in that period. And the lesser point is that any Koreans and Taiwanese who, being part of the Japanese Empire, were conscripted have also been inducted, contrary to the wishes of their families, tens of thousands of them.
So who exactly were these war criminals?
There are several types, according to the tribunal that was set up by the U.S. after World War II. Class A were those who actually ordered the start of the war. You know, it's actual crime against peace to wage war aggressively or without provocation. Then Class B and C were those who actually either carried out particular atrocities or had command responsibility. But it's very inconsistent. All members of the royal family were exempt, despite several princes being directly known to be involved in particularly, so for example, the Nanking Massacre in 1937, when maybe 250,000 Chinese were killed. And then also there was one guy, Shiro Ishii, who was in charge of the germ warfare tests on live prisoners and civilians. And he was exempt from being prosecuted because his data was useful to the U.S. But overall, we're looking at about almost 6,000 who were charged, and of whom about 1,000 were executed. And it's their spirits that have been inducted into the Yasukuni Shrine.
And one of these people, just to put a name to the concepts you're talking about, Prime Minister Tojo is buried there. Would he be considered a war criminal by China and South
buried,
Korea?
Not buried. His spirit is enshrined there. So your spirit is inducted. Your body could be anywhere.
So I see. Everybody's spirit is then inducted there.
Right. Yeah, right. There's about 2.5 million people in there.
So if it's so offensive for Mr. Abe, the Japanese prime minister, to go to this shrine, if it's so offensive to China and South Korea, why did he go?
Well, there's two things. One thing, he takes it very personally. His own grandfather was arrested by the Americans as a Class A war criminal. He was later released without actually being charged or prosecuted. But he has a very, you know, very real feeling of personal shame and stain attached to his family, at least the way he sees it. And close observers have said this means he's taken it to heart. That's made him a kind of a nationalist and in a sense, a historical revisionist. It also plays well to his base politically. He's a right-wing politician, so this fits in with a pattern of his willingness to confront China over territorial disputes and his attempt to change the constitutional nature of the armed forces from being like a self-defense force to an actual military force. And that triggers all kinds of hot buttons across the region that Japan might be becoming remilitarized.
So, Chris, how do modern Japanese feel about this? I mean, even during the war, there was a lot of bitterness about the way husbands and brothers were expected to die as heroes during the conflict instead of being captured.
Well, it's obviously a very real concern to a lot of Japanese, but it is that older generation who lived through this or who have immediate memories of their parents talking about it. The younger generation, part of the big problems and one of the grievances in China and other Asian nations is that the younger generation doesn't really know about what happened. There's been several polls that indicate that there's kind of an awareness that Japan was aggressive, but the extent of the atrocities is really not very well known.
The World's History Guy, Chris Wolf, thank you for telling us about the Yasukuni Shrine.
You're welcome.
Wow, is this really possible? This holiday season, the French are drinking less wine and drinking more beer? We hear this is probably due to a boom in microbrews, or bière artisanale, as they're called. The World's Jerry Haddon followed the trend to the southern port city of Marseille.
Midnight at an outdoor terrace. Three couples make a toast with beer. Regular old watery tap beer. One of the guys says, hey, this beer quenches the thirst. Which, if you think about it, doesn't seem like a very French answer. The French don't just sit down at a bistro and order alcohol to quench their thirst. They order it because it goes well with foie gras or raclette or just plain old brie. In other words, they order wine. Beer's traditionally been left out in the cold. But why?
But why is it in a country where food and drink are so valued that beer has been overlooked for so long?
I think it's because, like, for the past 60, 80 years after the war, you know, it started to have a big industrialization of the beer.
Salem Aji co-owns Marseille's first and only microbrewery.
And the beer became this alcoholic water that we know. I mean, the big brewery, they bought a small brewery just to close them down and to get a monopoly. And so they had the monopoly of the taste also. So for people, you know, beer was just a refreshing thing, you know, but that's it.
Aji's place is a tiny joint called Bière de la Plaine. It's part store, part bar, and part tubes, tubs, and bottling machines. He's out to crush the beer stereotype, like a cigarette under his boot.
I think that cheese and beer goes better than cheese and wine, especially red wine.
That's blasphemy in France, what you just said. That's blasphemy.
To me, red wine and cheese, that's blasphemy. I mean, because either the wine takes over the cheese or the cheese takes over the wine, but there's no wedding, no marriage.
Aji interrupts to attend to one of a steady stream of customers as he's explaining how his IPA has hints of Mandarin to a very excited, if perplexed-looking guy. Something occurs to me.
You're the Walter White of French microbrews. Have you ever seen the series Breaking Bad?
Yeah, oh, all right. You have to check something out.
Aji nods knowingly, mentions a recent newspaper article.
We passed a picture of me with this big industrial napkin.
He means apron.
And some guy wrote Brewing Bad. Yeah.
Brewing Bad is good. I know, because Haji's been plying me with his latest Chinook, a beer made from hops from, get this, the U.S. Northwest. You can even find Haji's beer now in wine shops, another first in Marseille. Wine shop owner Vincent Damiani is a huge fan of Haji's recipes.
Moi, ce que j'aime bien, alors qu'il est particulier...
I like to eat smoked fish with his porter or stout, he says. I asked myself why, then I realized the stout has a hint of soy sauce in it. So in my mouth, I have the sensation that I'm eating sushi. Across France, microbrews are quickly gathering fans, mainly in the north, where taxes on really good Belgian beers have turned some French into barley and hops entrepreneurs. Marseille is microbrewing's far-flung frontier. Aji's confident he's got a hit, but I put his IPA to the ultimate test. In the dive bar across the street. I buy a round of industrial tap beer for a couple of wobbly-legged clients named Georges and Jacques. Then I take out one of Aji's bottles from my bag, pour a second glass. Georges sniffs it, then takes a sip, and almost seems to forget it's beer.
Qu'est-ce qu'il y a? Un petit goût, n'est pas trop sucré.
There's a little something there, he says, licking his lips. What is that? I wouldn't say sugary, but fruity. I couldn't say what, but it's very agreeable. Grapefruit, perhaps, he guesses, or violet. I find it very nice. He finishes the entire glass without sharing with his pal. Test passed with flying colors. For The World, I'm Jerry Hatton, Marseille, France.
Mm-hmm. Jerry does his own science. You know, The World is more than a radio show. We're online 24/7 at PRI.org. That's where you'll find all our stories, not to mention videos and slideshows. It's also where you can subscribe to our daily and weekly podcasts. And if you hear something on the show you like or don't like, you can let us know also at PRI.org. You can also share your voice on our Twitter account and get the latest updates from the show throughout the day. We tweet at PRI The World. I tweet at Marco Werman. And if I just committed information overload, you can find all these links at PRI.org. You're listening to The World on PRI.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from Lookout. Lookout is dedicated to helping protect people and businesses from mobile threats, including device loss, malware, and spyware. You can download the Lookout app for Android and iPhone today. Learn more at Lookout.com.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. American solar panel manufacturers once dominated the global market, but for years China siphoned off American business, and now China dominates in solar panels. The Chinese are able to produce cheaper panels because they get a lot of government assistance. But this holiday season, American solar panel manufacturers got a bit of a gift from the U.S. military. The World's Jason Margolis joins me now. What did they get, actually?
The gift they got is the U.S. military will no longer be buying solar panels from China.
That seems pretty big. How did that come about?
So the U.S. Department of Defense issued an interim rule. It's a long legal document, and it essentially defines the country of origin for where solar panels are made. They call it the place where a substantial transformation occurred.
What does that actually mean?
Have you confused? So you've got to go back a little bit in history to the last day of Herbert Hoover's presidency in 1933. He signs what's called the Buy American Act. Essentially, it says that the American government will buy American-made products for highways, bridges, roads, et cetera, if they are competitive. But fast forward to the 21st century, well, what really is made in any place? You know, something has a piece of material from country A, it's manufactured in country B, then shipped to country C. So there are loopholes to what actually is made here in America.
So how are solar panel manufacturers going to sort through this long legal document? I mean, is it going to be clear to them?
So the legal document basically says, if it's made in the U.S. or one of the nations that has a free trade agreement with the U.S., that's okay. So about 20 nations now are on the approved list. What is off the list is China.
What's stopping the Pentagon then? What would stop the Pentagon from buying solar panels from any of these 20 countries on this list?
Nothing. That's the hard part. The U.S. still has to be competitive. So if Singapore or Mexico or Canada can make a better solar panel that's cheaper, the Department of Defense is probably going to buy their solar panels from them.
So is this such a big deal then?
Well, yeah, I think so. I talked to MJ Hsiao. He's a solar analyst with GTM Research here in Boston, and he went over some of the numbers with me. Right now, the Army, Navy, and Air Force operate about 1% of the installed solar panels in the U.S., but that could be just the tip of the iceberg. The Pentagon has big plans for solar in the next 5 years. It could install about 8 times as many solar panels on military bases, as well as homes for military personnel. And the Department of Defense has even bigger ambitions for renewable energy in general by the year 2025. Needless to say, the solar industry here in the U.S. is very excited about all of this.
The World's Jason Margolis. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Christian rock in the U.S. The market is pretty broad here. Billboard magazine even has a chart for the genre. Well, here's another place where you can find Christian rock, and it may surprise you. Pakistan. The country is overwhelmingly Muslim. Christians represent less than 2% of the population. But as Fahad Deshmukh reports from Karachi, they punch above their weight in Pakistan's music industry.
Christians have been playing music in what is today Pakistan since the first European colonizers arrived in the 18th century. In the 1880s, a Christian convert started translating the Psalms into Punjabi and composed a melody for each one based on local music traditions. This native form of the scripture was an instant success in the Christian community, and those melodies, like this rendition of Psalm number 16, continue to be a staple in Punjabi churches today. Some of the singers featured most prominently during the heyday of Pakistan's commercial film industry were from the Christian community. This is a famous song by Noel Diaz, more commonly known by his stage name Salim Raza. As early as the 1940s, jazz and rock cover bands made up of young Christian musicians were playing in Karachi's nightclubs. Many of them would gain a cult following in the city, with names like The Panthers, The In Crowd, and The Talisman.
When a child goes to church, he listens Christian hymns there.
Anthony Sushil, who goes by the nickname of Moon, plays keyboards for a band called Hallelujah. The Lahore-based group is one of a handful of Pakistani bands playing Christian-focused rock music.
He saw the choir, he saw the musicians, so he got a spark over there that, what is this, man? There is something new. First thing in the mind is that it cannot be wrong because it's in church.
So even though Christians make up a tiny proportion of Pakistan's population, they're overrepresented in the music industry. By day, Hallelujah's six members work as music producers and engineers for other musicians, TV commercials, and movie soundtracks. But in their free time, they get together and sing in a mix of Punjabi, Urdu, and some English about Jesus and spirituality. Their brand of Christian rock is catching on, like this song, Rehbar, or Guide. Dekhna, ab humko, hum sitaron se jagmagayenge. Tootti, bikharti, in kataron mein seedh laayenge. Hai kyun alag, alag si dishaen, jabke man. Rehbar is notable because the song's music video managed to get airplay on one of Pakistan's small but mainstream music TV channels. Hallelujah members say they're not trying to win over converts. What they want is to entertain and to spread a universal message to Pakistan's disparate Christian community. This is guitarist Waqar Gill.
You know, there are so many churches and so many denominations nowadays in Pakistan. So we don't want to present ourselves like from Catholics, from Protestants, or from Pentecostals. We just want to show that we are just Christians.
Being Christian in Pakistan today isn't easy. Christians have been increasingly targeted by Muslim extremists in recent years. In 2011, a Christian government minister was gunned down. Last September, a church in the northern city of Peshawar was attacked by suicide bombers, killing some 80 worshippers. Hallelujah and other Christian rockers aren't widely known outside of the Christian community, so at least for now, they don't perceive themselves to be under the threat of violence because of their music. Then again, because the Christian community is so small, it's unlikely they'll ever be a major act in Pakistan. But the band members say their music was never about getting mainstream popularity. For the world, I'm Fahad Desmukh in Karachi, Pakistan.
And that's our show today. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. Back with you tomorrow.
The World is a co-production of the BBC World Service, Public Radio International, and WGBH Boston, supported in part by the Luce Foundation's Henry R. Luce Initiative on Religion and International Affairs, by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world, macfound.org, by the Annenberg Foundation, and by the WGBH Fund for Environmental Reporting, whose donors include the Grantham Foundation for the Protection of the Environment, supporting a cooperative approach to solving our critical environmental problems while we still can, and by the PRI Global Reporting Fund, providing in-depth reporting on a diverse array of important topics, including global health. Donors to the fund include Marguerite Steed Hoffman and Blythe Brendan Mann Foundation.
PRI, Public Radio International.